Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Our guest today will be Brent Andrews. He's the author of The Pot Plan. I know you'll find this very informative, especially if you're having a hard time with multi-drug use, alcohol use, controlling a life that seems hell-bent on destruction. A bit later, depending on time, we'll also hear reports from David Williams of Citizens Against Government Waste. We'll hear from Paul Armentano of Normal. If we have the chance, we'll hear from some of our Drug Truth Network reporters as well. But first, our interview with Brent Andrews. Our guest on this edition of Cultural Baggage is author Brent Andrews. He's the author of The Pot Plan, and a man who has seen this drug war in, I think, much the same perspective as myself. Welcome, Brent.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. Tell the folks a bit about yourself, your history, and so forth.
Well, I'm a journalist. I was a journalist in the daily newspaper business for 5 years. After that time, I got fed up with the war on drugs and started writing about it. Once I started writing about the war on drugs, I was threatened by the police. So I went into hiding and wrote The Pot Plan.
We both have a history of multi-drug use, of alcoholism. Let's talk about that.
Well, that's a shared history of a lot of Americans, Dean.
I was wanting you to give some of your background, your reasons for writing this book.
I never knew why I did drugs. Over the years, it seemed silly sometimes. I would end up in some terrible situations, especially mixing pills, mixing alcohol with pills, mixing alcohol with other drugs. As you probably are aware, that will have a tendency to knock you out. It could kill you. It could be fatal. I never knew why I sampled all the drugs, Dean, but I sampled everything I could find. I was experimenting, I guess, and I finally stumbled onto something in experimenting. What I found was, I found that by applying a concentrated marijuana program, I could quit drinking. I made it easy. My ultimate favorite drug was alcohol. It was the easiest to get. It was the most dangerous for me. Out there on the highway, I was in and out of jail due to drinking. Eventually, after I'd tried everything, including AA, rehab, all that, I applied a marijuana program, which is to say, when I felt like drinking, I smoked pot instead. I've been sober 5 years, Dean.
Well, I want to commend you on that and offer up, it's possible to keep that number growing. May 8th made 20 years for me without a drink.
1985 was your big year, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. 5885. I think there's some luck in that combination of numbers for me.
Well, once this happened for me, I think it's happened for a lot of other people as well, Dean. Since I wrote The Pot Plan, I've run into 10 or 11 people who have told me, hey, I applied The Pot Plan in my life. I quit heroin. I quit alcohol. I smoked pot. I didn't feel like doing those other drugs again. All of a sudden, I had my life back. This is my story. When I did this, I knew as a journalist that if I didn't tell the story, I was not only not fulfilling my moral obligation to other addicts and alcoholics, but I was not doing my job.
I agree with you. Now, I went through Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a good and solid member for 6 months. But when I began to report that marijuana helped to end those cravings, helped to get my life back on track, I was no longer accepted.
Of course, you can be shut out of AA over this, and I never was, because I didn't realize that this could help until I had given up on the AA. I consider myself one of the unfortunates. For some reason, I will do that drug. I will pick up that bottle again. I don't know why. You know, no one has solved the riddle of addiction yet. However, when I applied the pot plan, I quit drinking. In AA, my only choice was total abstinence, and I just couldn't live with that for whatever reason. You know, call it weakness if you will, call it what you will, but the pot plan worked for me.
Brent, it's a bold move. This book you've written exposes your life to a degree most folks would not find possible. And this is something that we can all learn from by examining our lives.
Dean, I put everything in there because this book is my resume, first of all, to alcoholics. I've been there, and I had to write it so that other alcoholics will know. I've been to the very bottom. This is the way that I found a way out of my terrible alcohol problem. I think my book can help other alcoholics, and the idea is eventually to give this book away. I haven't found a way exactly to do that yet, but I'm still searching.
You talked about that history. I too had many similar situations. I was arrested 13 times while I was drinking.
13 times? Wow, you have me beat by many.
but the main reason was for possession of drugs while I was drunk.
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm saying, because through inebriation, I was unable to hide or control the situation in any fashion.
And you might have been mixing.
Well, absolutely right. Now, Brent, you talked about giving this book away because it's giving a truth away. It's giving a real examination of what alcohol and drugs can do to a life and that there is a better way.
Alcohol certainly just about tore my life apart. It wrecked my marriage for a while, and I had to really struggle to get those things back and straighten things out. I just used a sort of alternate plan to sobriety, and, you know, maybe I'll be condemned for it, maybe I'll be a great success, but I have to share this message with alcoholics. They call that 12-stepping in AA, and I always wanted to go straight to step 12, skip all those other steps in the middle. You can't do that. AA has to be worked a certain way, and it works for many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. However, there are the unfortunates, and AA is not working for them. Jail is certainly not working for them. There's a different way out, and this story is not only for the alcoholic, but for the alcoholic's grandmother. I wrote the pot plan with very little, well, as little swearing as I could get in there, and I tried to write it as clean as possible so that a grandmother, a mother, could get hope out of this book. I would be happy to just tell you a little bit about the analysis of my journalism career in the book. I spent those 5 years at Daily Papers and had a great time. I loved being a reporter. When I left journalism, it was because I had found the pot plan story that I had to write, and I didn't see a way that I could write that at the newspaper with the objective voice that the newspaper requires. I wanted to be a passionate critic of the war on drugs, and that's what I became. I kind of had to go out and do that on my own, and that's okay.
Well, given the mindset of the public, the demonization that tends to be slung about, it's a bold move. And was there a point in time, a moment when you decided to do this, or was it a gradual determination?
When I quit the newspaper business and joined Normal, became an advocate, Dean, I started writing this story just one piece at a time for local newspapers. I was threatened by the police directly. My business was threatened. My very existence was threatened. This is all documented in the pot plan. I decided I couldn't tell the story in bits and pieces anymore and die the death of a thousand cuts that these local drug agents who threatened me were determined to see me die. They were going to slander me one piece at a time, one issue at a time. Well, I went home. I hid from these guys. I couldn't write for the newspaper anymore, but I could write for myself. I wrote the pot plan, and I'm sharing the whole story. This book solves some crimes, Dean. I hope that journalists will like it.
Well, it exposes what the drug war does to people, how it drives them away from family, how it disrupts progress, and in many ways forces people to hide out, as you say.
No one should ever go to jail for possession of pot alone. It's time for the war on drugs to be over, and we need to get over our drug problem and move on with our lives.
Well, Brent, since you've been publicizing your book, since you've been out in the community, what has been the reaction? My opinion is that the majority of people are now for ending the drug war.
I think what we hear in the sound bites and the extreme positions against drugs are often coming from politicians with a different agenda than the average American has. I think the average American knows that the drug war is a failure. And do you mind if I quote you, Dean? The war on drugs is the largest fraud ever perpetrated. People know that. Mainstream America knows that. I have a story that's not exactly mainstream. It's a look into the heart of the war on drugs and my problems with alcohol and a potential solution that I don't think has been publicized yet. The pot plant has been tried and used. It's worked for people. But I don't think there's been a book like mine before. And I hope people will like it, and people who need it will get it, and people who read it will just simply enjoy it.
Well, is there a location on the web where they could learn more about it?
My personal website is chronicdiscontent.com. That's chronic as in chronic alcoholic. Chronicdiscontent.com is my personal site. And, of course, Cafe Press is my printer, and they have the book is searchable, The Pot Plan, on the cafepress.com website.
Well, once again, we've been talking with Brent Andrews, the author of The Pot Plan and a very brave soul. Thank you for joining us on today's Cultural Baggage.
Dean, I appreciate your help, and thanks for all your hard work with Cultural Baggage and since 2001 and helping us end this war on drugs.
Okay, we're going to take our midpoint break just a little bit early. Bow down to the drug czars. Hand them a key to your house and car. Give them full dominion to put chains upon our children. 500 billion to these taskers and 5 trillion to their masters. It's a drug war till the end of time. What's ours is theirs and so divine. Bow down to the drug czar and do it now.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Patients, their families, and caregivers are encouraged to be on the alert for the emergence of anxiety, agitation, panic attacks, insomnia, irritability, hostility, aggressiveness, impulsivity, psychomotor restlessness, hypomania, mania, and other unusual changes in behavior, worsening of depression, and suicidal ideation. Time's up. The answer, Remeron Saltab for depression, another FDA-approved product.
Law enforcement against prohibition. These men and women have served in the trenches of the drug war as prosecutors, judges, cops, guards, and wardens. They have seen firsthand the utter futility of our policy and now work together to end drug prohibition. Please visit leap.cc.
You know, every week I bring you reasons why you should get on board, why you should be part of the solution, not part of the problem, by ignoring all this evidence of the fraud of prohibition that's all around us. And nowhere is it more glaringly obvious, pitiful, and costly than in these ONDCP drug ads. A little earlier, I got a chance to talk with David Williams from Citizens Against Government Waste.
David Williams, I'm the Vice President for Policy for Citizens Against Government Waste.
I saw a report that your organization issued that talked about the fact that the Drug Czar's office is a federal wasteland. Would you fill us in on some details why you would make that conclusion?
Absolutely. Citizens Against Government Waste did a comprehensive look at ONDCP, the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And in particular, we looked at the media advertising campaign to try to reduce drug use and actually halt drug use in America. And we have uncovered that $4.2 billion has been wasted of American taxpayer dollars since 1997 on this advertising campaign. And also, ONDCP officials are going into different states to try to kill medicinal marijuana legislation, which they really have no authority to do.
This is a recurring problem. They change their focus year to year, and as their presentation is proven rather dubious, they move on to another reason why. What's your take? I mean, where are they headed now? I understand they're spending more than half their dollars on marijuana.
Right now, ONDCP seems like a boat without an anchor. They're just drifting along, changing their mission every year as to what they think is important and how to reduce drug use. And every attempt that they make, they fail. We're just saying that this has been an ineffective program, and also the state ballot initiatives really gets to the heart of federalism and whether or not federal officials should be going into individual states trying to manipulate state ballot initiatives.
If people are tired of seeing their hard-earned tax dollars used for efforts like this, where might they learn more on the net?
What they can do is they can get our full report at cagw.org, and it really details all of the waste at ONDCP, and we hope to do a follow-up report in the coming year because we've just peeled away kind of one layer of the onion here, and we hope to really get to the nuts and bolts of this in our follow-up report. But it's quite interesting to see just comprehensively how the U.S. has really just lost the war on drugs, and it's our own fault, the federal government's fault, for really directing resources to the wrong areas and spending billions of dollars on a media campaign that's just failed people and the taxpayers miserably.
Please, my dear friends, embolden yourself with the truth. Arm yourself with facts. Please visit their website, cagw.org. You know, I think things are just as messed up in Canada as they are in the U.S. They just had a new election up in British Vancouver, so I thought I'd give a call to Philippe Lucas.
My name is Philippe Lucas, and I'm founder and director of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, founder of Canadians for Safe Access, and one of about 800 or so Canadians currently legally allowed to use medicinal marijuana.
Philippe, I see that the elections were recently held. What does that portend?
Was an interesting election. Over the last 4 years, we've had a really ridiculous majority government run by the BC Liberals. They've been, despite their name, taken a very right-wing approach to BC. They've been cutting services such as women's shelters and cutting money for hospitals and cutting spending on education. And luckily, we've seen a bit of a shift to the left again. The NDP, the New Democratic Party, did pretty well and are coming in with a good solid minority to finally be able to challenge this very right-wing agenda of the Liberal government.
What does this portend for drug policy, marijuana policy?
Well, not much, unfortunately. The NDP that just gained back a little bit of power, they were in power for most of the 90s, and although officially their position is to support decriminalization of cannabis, they didn't act on it while they had the reins of government. But I think that there are some members within the provincial NDP who would like to see a policy shift towards more modern approach to drug policy drug policy enforcement. And so we're certainly going to use that opportunity to try and get BC's enforcement priorities right.
Philippe, there are so many bizarre machinations, twists and turns that spiral forth from this prohibition. Tell us about some in Canada.
Well, we had two very sad and interesting stories this week out of Canada. A police officer, in fact, a 27-year veteran of the Vancouver Police Department, and who's a former head of the Vancouver Drug Squad named Cash Heed, did a report and a study of 600 street-level dealers arrested in Vancouver over an 18-month period, and he found that instead of making drugs harder to buy, drug busts actually make street drugs cheaper and easier to buy, because those dealers that replace the ones that are taken off the street inevitably lower their prices in order to increase their market as they take over a new area. And so when you've got a former leader of the Vancouver Drug Squad, a police officer and a well-recognized and respected one, telling us that his own actions are making the problem worse, I think we have to listen to them. Now, the real evidence of that and the contrast of that is that in North York, a small town outside of Toronto, a 45-year-old woman fell to her death off her 15-floor balcony earlier this week because police were showing up at her apartment to investigate a water leak from her apartment, and it turns out that she was growing a small amount of cannabis there and was actually climbing down from her 15th-floor balcony to try and escape arrest from those police officers. And so just in that single incident, we've seen a greater loss of life as a result of the Canadian prohibition on cannabis than we have from cannabis use over 5,000 years of recorded historical use.
If you'd like to learn more about what's going on up in Canada, I urge you to visit Philippe's website, and that's at vix.org. That's vics.org. Last week, the editors of USA Today brought forward the subject of marijuana. I immediately heard about objections coming from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
Paul Armentano, I'm a senior policy analyst for NORML and the NORML Foundation in Washington, D.C.
Today, there was an editorial and a rejoinder from our drug czar, John Walters, about the subject of marijuana. You want to capture the thoughts brought forward?
Clearly, the drug czar's office is feeling pressure of late and feeling the need to respond to the fact that annually the number of drug arrests, mostly arrests for the simple possession of marijuana, have literally skyrocketed over the last decade, doubling from about 350,000 per year in the early 90s to well over 700,000 arrests per year today. Walters in USA Today felt the need to respond to these rising arrests and, in fact, tried to play down the fact that so many Americans are being arrested on a yearly basis for marijuana possession by claiming that, well, in fact, the arrest is no big deal because many of those people don't go to jail. They're often sent to drug courts, and then they're given the choice between going to jail or going to mandatory treatment for their use of marijuana. Not surprisingly, most of those individuals choose treatment, which has allowed the drug czar to then conveniently try to claim that marijuana is more dangerous today because there's a record of individuals now in treatment for marijuana, which in fact is simply a result of the rising arrests that have been overseen by the likes of the drug czar and the ONDCP.
It's a conundrum. It revolves in a circle, doesn't it?
Sure, it's clearly a vicious circle. Interestingly, too, Walters has tried to deny that there has been any shift in the prioritization of law enforcement over the last decade, when, in fact, the numbers that the Sentencing Project presented and that other groups have demonstrated show that, in fact, arrests for virtually all other drugs, particularly cocaine and heroin, have gone down dramatically over the last decade, at the same time that simple arrests for marijuana possession have gone up dramatically.
If they want to learn more about this, where might they go on the web?
We would encourage them to go to NORML's website at www.norml.org, and certainly we would encourage people to sign up for our free e-zine so that they can receive our news releases.
For those of you out there ready to bow down before the drug czar, here's Winston Francis with the official government truth.
On Tuesday, April 26, 2005, Florida State Trooper Sergeant George A. Brown radios in the tag number of a vehicle as he prepares for a routine traffic stop. But something happens. The driver, 31-year-old Gregory Platt, slams on his brakes suddenly and deliberately. The officer swerves to miss Mr. Platt's car, crashes his own patrol car, and dies. Mr. Platt was arrested the next day after leading the police on a dangerous high-speed chase. The obvious question here is, what caused Gregory Platt to behave in this manner? Well, on May 8, 2005, in an interview with the Citrus County Chronicle, Mr. Platt explains, quote, "It's the drugs. It's all the drugs." Unquote. You see, Mr. Platt had been using cocaine. What do you think? An excuse? A cop-out? Not according to the government. According to the ONDCP and WhiteHouseDrugPolicy.gov, cocaine causes irritability, restlessness, anxiety, paranoia, and leads to erratic and violent behavior. In fact, according to the National Drug Intelligence Center's National Drug Threat Assessment of 2003, cocaine, because of its high rate of overdose and its relation to violence, is the primary drug threat in the U.S. How big of a threat? Well, the Arrestee Drug Abuse Monitoring Program, or ADAM, collects data on arrestees testing positive for cocaine. In 2002, the Atlanta-based ADAM site reported 49.4% of male arrestees tested positive for cocaine, and the Indianapolis site reported 55.2% of female arrestees tested positive. Drug legalization advocates would have you believe that allowing dangerous drugs such as cocaine to be readily available to the public is in the best interest of America. But use your eyes, your common sense, and check out the facts for yourself at WhiteHouseDrugPolicy.gov. I'm Winston Francis. This has been the official Government Truth.
And here's my answer to Winston about what caused this situation.
I'm not going back to jail.
Out of the car, motherfucker!
Get your hands up where we can see them! Oh my God, he's dead.
One last criminal on the streets. Fight or flight, what will you do? What will you do? Please visit drugwarfacts.org. We've got just enough time to squeeze in this report from Bill Piper of the Drug Policy Alliance, dpa.org.
Congressman Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, who's chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has introduced legislation that, among other things, would require people to report certain drug offenses within 24 hours and then provide full assistance to the police in capturing and prosecuting the people involved. And, you know, it's pretty sweeping in terms of the offenses that you would have to report. You know, for instance, if your cousin told you that he gave a marijuana joint to his roommate in college, or if you find out that your daughter, who's addicted to drugs, begged her boyfriend to find her some drugs, and they're both in drug treatment. Both of those are examples in which either if you witness the offense or if you've learned of it, so if they just tell you or you somehow learn that it happened, you have to report the offense within 24 hours or you face a mandatory two-year prison term. Actually, it could be up to 10 years, but at least 2 years has to be mandatory. So it's a pretty serious offense.
Asking people to become informants, narcs, in fact.
Yeah, it pretty much makes every American a government spy. It's similar to, Ashcroft had an initiative that he called Operation Tips, where he encouraged Americans to spy on each other. So if you were a delivery man, like a UPS man, you dropped off a package, and you saw that someone had a copy of, you know, Soldier of Fortune or the Quran or whatever, you were encouraged to report that to the police. But where this differs is that Ashcroft didn't go this far. All he did was encourage people to spy on their neighbors, which is pretty bad. This legislation would make it a crime not to spy on your neighbor.
KGB is just way too easy, but can anybody out there spell Stasi? And as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Chap dancing on the edge of an abyss.